I'm trying to do a panorama of the whole of Europe. That does around little biographies of women. Two volumes are already out, one for Germany and Italy, two for France and England. Now I'm working on the third, and the material is now ready for Spain and Poland and Sweden. I've still to do Scotland, Denmark, Norway, if I can find a woman in the 16th century, I want to stick in that century, and Hungary. There'll be a big problem on language, I can't read it. But some of the material will be in Latin and in German, and we have a number of Hungarians in our neighborhood who can give me some help. I've been asked why I undertook this, partly because I think the women have never had their due, and I did not awaken to this only after liberation got underway. For many years ago, I did an article on the role of the minister's wife in old New England. But I've been interested in doing it partly because these women were magnificent persons, whether they were men or women. And despite all of their limitations, they succeeded in being profoundly influential. And another point is to see the Reformation from the point of view of personal and often family relations. There's a whole new dimension to the story if one looks at it not from the point of view of synods and conferences and wars and creeds, but from the point of view of the loyalties, the divisions in families, the common sufferings which the religious controversies entail. Well, now today I'm going to take two from Germany and one from France. And the first one is Luther's wife, Catherine von Bora. Kierkegaard said Luther might just as well have married a plank, because all he wanted to do was to prove that he approved of the clergy getting married. Well, if Catherine was a plank, she was hard wood, smooth beautifully on one side and slightly rough on the other. But actually, this is not the story at all. Luther didn't marry her to prove anything except that he was a responsible individual. She was a nun. She was converted along with eight others to Luther's view that monasticism is not primarily a way to salvation. In consequence, these nuns decided that they would like to leave. One may ask, of course, how Luther's writings ever got into a nunnery. Well, we get light on that in another case, the instance of a woman who left, and after her departure, 75 of the nuns were examined as to what had been going on for the last year or two. And this brought to light the fact that Luther's books were smuggled through the window of the choir and sometimes brought in sacks which were supposed to contain flour and then were copied and passed around. These girls then wanted to leave. But for them to leave would be exceedingly dangerous because they were in the territory of Duke George. Saxony was divided into two sections. The Germans in that period had the very bad practice of dividing up territory between sons and just fragmentizing the whole political area. There were two Saxonies, one under Frederick the Wise, the other under his cousin, Duke George. Frederick was the friend of Luther, and Duke George was a virulent foe. A man who had abetted the escape of nuns in the territory of Duke George, having been caught, was executed. How then were these girls to get over the boundary of the territory of Duke George into that of Frederick the Wise? They consulted Luther. By correspondence, of course. Well, Luther got hold of a man who periodically delivered barrels of dried herring to the sisters. And it was agreed that on the night when Christ rose from the dead, the sisters would rise from their couches and make a rendezvous with the man who delivered the herring. It is often said that they escaped in the barrels. In that case, they should retroactively be awarded crowns of martyrdom. But the chronicle says they escaped as if they had been the barrels. And what he did with the barrels, I don't know. But at any rate, By Tuesday after Easter, the wagon rolled into Wittenberg. A contemporary said, "A wagon load of Vestal virgins has just come to town, all more eager for marriage than for life. God grant them husbands, lest worse befall." Well, Luther was determined that worse should not befall. So he got in touch with all of their relatives, and none of them would have back and escape none. So then he found a teaching job for one, and placement in domestic service for a number, and husbands for others, until Catherine was left over. The reason was not that she was lacking in attractiveness. There was a young gentleman from Nuremberg who was in love with her, went home saying that he would come back and marry her. But when he got home, his parents were violently opposed to his marrying and escaping none, and he didn't come back. Luther wrote him and said, "If you want her, you better come back, or else somebody else will get her." Well, he made up his mind to marry somebody else. Luther didn't blame him. He believed that whereas parents should never force a marriage on children, children should never marry without the consent of parents. So in after years, in writing to him, he would conclude his letter, "Greetings from me and your old flame." But that left Katie. So Luther picked out somebody else for her, a certain Dr. Glatz. And why he didn't go and tell her himself, I don't know, but he asked his friend Amsdorf to make the suggestion. She said, "I won't have Dr. Glatz nullo modo." She could talk Latin. "By no means would she have Dr. Glatz. But," she said, "I might consider you, Amsdorf, or Luther." Well, they were both considerably older, and she probably thought it wasn't realistic, so it was all right to suggest. Well, Amsdorf wasn't inclined, so he passed the word on to Luther. Well, Luther had had no intention of marrying. He said if anybody had told him at the Diet of Worms that in 5 years he'd be married and have 3 children, he would have laughed him to scorn. And after Luther was back in Wittenberg, a woman wrote him and said, "You ought to get married to show that you believe in it." He said, "My dear, I'm not a sexless log or stone, but it won't do for me to get married. I may be burned any day." Well, that was realistic. He was on the death row for 25 years. He was under the ban of the Church and the Empire. And if Frederick the Wise hadn't protected him, and if the emperor had not been too engaged in wars with the French and the Turks and the Pope to get up to Germany, Luther would have been burned. The emperor was free to come only the year after Luther died. So Luther thought it wasn't responsible for him to get married when he was in that situation. But then came the case of Katie, and he thought it over. And 42 years of age, he went home to get the consent of his father and mother. It was given very readily, for his father had long desired that he would marry. And Luther said, "I now have an arsenal of reasons. It will please my father, it will rile the Pope, it will make the angels laugh and the devils weep, and it will seal my testimony." He didn't pretend that this was a romantic match. The Reformation in general was not romantic. People married first and fell in love afterwards. They married for conviction and for convenience. And with Katie, it was mainly convenience. And for Luther, it was mainly conviction. He said, "I'm not madly in love with my wife. I cherish her. I wouldn't exchange her for France or for Venice. For God has given her to me, and other women have worse faults." But after a year, he said, "I wouldn't change her for the riches of Croesus." And when he thought she was dying, he said, "Stir me on me. Don't die on me, Katie." He began to call her in his Latin letters, Carissima. And in his German letters, meine Herzliebe, Katie. He called his favorite Pauline epistle, the Epistle to the Galatians, meine Katharina von Bora, my Catherine from Bora. and he began to get worried that he was paying more attention to Katie than to Christ. Well, marriage brought changes. He said, it's strange to wake up in the morning and find pigtails on the pillow. But that wasn't all of it. He felt that his liberty was being restricted. He wanted to go to a wedding at Torgau, but this was in the period of the Peasants' War, and the peasants were ravaging the countryside. It was dangerous. Katie said, you're not going. And he didn't. But the worst of it was that she interfered with his giving. Luther said that God divided the fingers on the hand so that money would slip through. And all that you give away, he will recompense. Well, God would have had a hard time without Katie. The Archbishop of Mainz, the very one against whom Luther had directed his theses, actually generously sent a present at the wedding. Luther was going to send it back, but he found Katie had already accepted it. And on another occasion, he wrote to a friend saying, I am sending you a vase for a wedding present. P.S. The crafty Katie has hit it. He began to call her in Latin, not Domina, my lady, but Dominus, my lord. And he would sometimes pun on Katie as Keta, chains, and write to another man whose wife was Katie from chains to chains. But his ordinary greeting at the end of a letter was, I and my rib send greetings to you and your rib and all the little ribs. Well, it was quite a chore for Katie to look after him. He was a difficult man with his moods and his diseases. She was very skilled on the medical side. Their son Paul, who became a doctor, said that she was half of one at least. She knew all about massages and herbs and poultices and the like, and took care of Luther in his various difficulties. The stone was one of the chief. And then his moods, because a man who read my biography of Luther said, he sounds to me like a manic depressive, but just see what he did with it. But he certainly had his ups and his downs. He said that Satan assails me worst at night. And then I roll over and say, Katie, forbid me to have such thoughts. But he was assailed during the day sometimes, was very depressed, and then she'd harness the horse and take him for a ride in the woods, and he'd soon be singing like the birds. But then there was not only Luther to look after, but a whole household. the elector, Frederick the Wise, turned over to Luther and Katie the Augustinian monastery in which he had been a monk. And that's all. I mean to say, that's all he turned over. And Luther had no money. He had come from the monastery. And Katie had none. She'd come from the nunnery. He had a little salary, to be sure, but that wasn't intended for a man with a family. Therefore, they took in boarders, student boarders, so that their table at times would have about 25 people. And Katie had to supervise all of the provisions and the cooking and the help. They had to have some help. And then by and by the children came, and that made some more, and then all the household servants, they would come in for it. Luther and Emily would give a little sermonette every morning in family prayers, and the students would take down every last word of it, for which we're very grateful. All of this she had to look after, and the problem was how to support it all. She resolved to make it self-supporting. She divided the cellar up. One section was devoted to a laundry and for bathing, and the other for a brewery. Luther said she brewed the best beer in Germany, and he was very fond of that. He had a mug which had engraved around the top of it the Ten Commandments, and around the middle the Apostles' Creed, and around the bottom the Lord's Prayer. And he was very proud that his friend Agricola could never drink farther than the Ten Commandments, but Luther could always go through the Lord's Prayer. Well, Katie did all the brewing, she did all the slaughtering too. And this is an account of what she had. She had a garden with peas, beans, turnips, cabbage, lettuce, cucumbers, and melons. An orchard, with cherries, pears, apples, peaches, nuts, grapes, mulberries, and figs. She extracted Luther's consent to take on a little piece of land with a creek in it, and he was very glad because out of it she got pike, trout, perch, and carp. A listing of her livestock gave 8 pigs, 5 cows, 9 calves, besides chickens, pigeons, geese, and the immortal dog, Telfer. Well, all of this, Katie had to supervise. And then, whenever a student was given a doctor's degree, the Lutherans put on a banquet, and she set 121 plates. And the same thing was true for a wedding. And then refugees would come pouring in from other places, even from England, even from Hungary, from other parts of Germany. Elisabeth of Brandenburg, and they always went to the Luthers for their entertainment. A stupendous task Katie had. She took part in all of the table conversation, and from this we get a few little inklings of her character. She was very respectful to Luther. She called him Herr Doktor. She said, "Herr Doktor, what is the difference between rhetoric and dialectic?" He said, "Dialectic is knowing how to do the washing, and rhetoric is getting it done." He said he'd give her a prize if she'd read all of the Bible by Easter. But after a month or two, she said, "I read enough. And I know enough. But I don't do enough. I'm going to stop reading it and start doing it." So occasionally, she could disagree with him. More than occasionally, I suspect. Then the children began to come. Luther wrote to a friend, "Katie is fulfilling Genesis 3:8. 9 months later, little Hans was born, named for Luther's father. Luther wrote to a friend, "I want you to be his godfather and come for his baptism, that from a little heathen he be made into a Christian, and I hope he'll be an enemy of the Pope and the Turk." Then came little Elizabeth, who lived only a year. Luther said, "How strange it is that parents are so affected by the loss of a child." And then came Martin. Luther said, "The youngest is always the favorite." He saw Martin at the breast and he said, "Child, your enemies are Duke George, the Pope, and the devil, and there you are sucking unconcernedly. Truly Christ said we must be his little children." And when he saw Katie fondling Martin, he said, "Surely Christ must be as loving to us as Katie with his Martinishin, with her Martinishin." Then came Lenchen, named for an aunt. Luther was extremely fond of her. She was taken in her 14th year. Luther held her in his arms as she was passing, and Katie stood beside. And when she was laid away, he said, "How strange it is to know that all is well and that she is with Christ, and yet to be so sorrowful. My little Lenchen, I can never forget her." And then came Margaret. He called her Margaretula, and he spoke of the sweetness of her voice in family singing. These were the children. I was once asked after a lecture, what became of Luther's children? I said, "They all died." Of course, the question was, what did they do before they died? And on that point, I was able to answer only with regard to Paul. He became a doctor. And Margaret became the ancestress of all of the descendants of Luther. They number the hundreds, into the hundreds now. But no one was descended on the male line. Well, now, at the end of his life, Luther went emotionally to pieces. It's understandable when a man has been engaged in such terrific activity, suffering from so many assaults, and constantly under the danger of death. He left home, he wrote back to Katie and said,
I'm not coming back. I can't stand Wittenberg. It's a Sodom and a Gomorrah. I'm not coming back. Well, she showed the letter to Melanchthon and some friends, and they went and got him and brought him home. And he rallied. And then a request came from two quarreling dukes that Luther should come and arbitrate. Or they didn't ask Luther. I mean, they asked Melanchthon. Melanchthon was too sick to go. Luther was too sick to live, but he went. And Katie sent the two boys along in case. We have the last letters. He wrote back and said, I'm somewhat better, but I don't feel well enough to look at pretty women, so you're in no danger. In the next letter, he said, Jonas, who was with him, has hurt his leg. He didn't want me to be the only one. It was something to grumble about. But he said, why are you everlastingly worrying? If you keep on worrying, I think the ceiling will fall in and crush us all. Haven't you read your catechism? Let God worry. Then he writes and says, the dispute has been settled. We've had a banquet for the two dukes. The Countess of Hohenlohe is very pleased, and she's sending you a present of trout. There are rumors of wars. We know not what will come. And the end did come for Luther. And the boys were there. So then Katie was a widow. And now the problem arose, which Luther had long foreseen, of what she would do when he was gone, seeing that she would probably live a good many years longer. They were about 20 years apart. She thought the best investment was land. He said, land is no good unless you work it. And if you don't work it, it's just an encumbrance. But she did get a farm, and she worked it herself. And now the elector suggested to her that she give up the farm and give up the Augustinian monastery. She and her daughter, Margaret, could have a little apartment, and he would give them enough to live on. And all the boys should be sent off to school. Not Katie. She was going to keep that monastery. She was going to have student boarders again. She'd have her garden and her orchard, and she'd get a little more land, a little closer to Wittenberg. She argued for nearly 2 years with the elector over it, and she finally got it, and she planted it, and she reaped it herself. And then came the four horsemen of the apocalypse. At last, the emperor was able to invade Germany, and Wittenberg was besieged. With the children, she fled to Magdeburg. The war receded. She came back, found everything in desolation, her garden dug up, her orchard cut, the monastery pillaged, nothing left but the building. She started in to put it into shape again. Another wave of war, another flight, another return, another desolation, and another attempt at reconstruction. And then came the last horseman, the plague. She had with her then only Paul and Margaret. They harnessed up the horse and took the cart to flee to Torgau. On the way, the horse bolted. She jumped, thinking she could control better from the side, but she slipped, came down on the small of her back, rolled into a ditch of cold water. She was retrieved and taken into Torgau, and Paul and Margaret was now 18, nursed her to the end, which came after a few months. Her last words were, I'll stick to Christ as a burr to a top coat. The marriage meant a great deal for Luther. He called it the school for character. Here it is, he said, that your corners get rubbed off. And it's a much more fruitful way of salvation than the monastery. Commenting on the marriage at Cana, he said, Mary came to Jesus and said, the wine is given out. So that's the way it often is in marriage. I've seen young people who, when they got married, were infatuated, and in 6 months they're just quarreling with each other. Satan spent a lot of time breaking up marriages, and I have to spend most of my mind trying to put them together again, and I've hardly got time to do my sermons. That's the way it is. The wine gives out. And Jesus doesn't take away the water. And he doesn't take away the vexation in marriage. He may even increase it. But he turns the water into wine. And they only know how sweet it is who have known it. Now I'll turn to another, that Catherine Sell. She was called the mother of the Reformation in Strasbourg. She married her husband when he was still a Catholic priest. Very shortly, 7 priests in Strasbourg married, and the bishop excommunicated them all. She then came out with a defense, and she got it printed. She said, "I know I shall be told that I should follow the precept of the Apostle Paul that women should be silent, but I would remind you that he said that in Christ there's neither male nor female, and I would remind you of the word of the prophet Joel, who said in the last days your sons and your daughters will prophesy. I don't pretend to be Nathan rebuking David. I don't pretend to be John the Baptist rebuking the Pharisees. I pretend to be only Balaam's ass rebuking his master." The year after their marriage, the neighboring town of Kensingen suffered a calamity because the Austrian emperor banished the minister. One must remember that Strasbourg was an imperial city and had special privileges, but the countryside did not. So this minister was banished, and 100 of the men of his parish went out with him some 3 miles to say a farewell. When they came back, they found all of the gates guarded by Austrian soldiers, and one of the men was caught and executed on the spot. They turned around and fled to the river, and in small boats they came down to Strasbourg. Catherine bedded and fetted 60 of them for several weeks and got provision in the city for the remainder. And then she wrote a little tract of comfort for their wives left behind. You may wonder how that could ever reach them, but some Catholic in Strasbourg, for that matter, would have free access and would not be unwilling to take in a letter of comfort. She said, "If the Lord had chosen to let me suffer for his name as you are doing, I should count myself more privileged than the chief magistrate of Strasbourg in his robes and with his golden chain. And now I would remind you of all the consolations of Scripture." And she goes on to give many passages. There are 2 copies of that tract in this country, one in St. Louis and one in Chester, Pennsylvania, so that I was successful in getting hold of it. Then, in 1525, came the Great Peasants' War, and Strasbourg was surrounded by bands of peasants. 2 of the ministers, one of them, her husband, Matthew Tsell, accompanied by Catherine, went out and visited all of those camps of the peasants and begged them to abstain from violence. They wouldn't listen. The result was that they were defeated and many slaughtered. And then stragglers and their wives and their children poured into Strasbourg, 2,000 strong. That would make them about 1/10 of the population. And Catherine was largely responsible for making provision. At first, they put as many as they could into the great Franciscan church, but they found that to put old and young, male and female, sick and well together was not advantageous. The best thing was to put them into private homes. And Catherine arranged it all without a telephone. And it went on for some 6 months that she was in charge of all of these arrangements. Now, of course, you'll ask, well, how could she do all that if she had a family? Well, she had only 2 children who died very young and never anymore. And so she devoted all the rest of her life to the parish. She entertained all of the ministerial visitors who came through Strasbourg. She entertained Zwingli, she entertained John Calvin. And for a time there were conferences between Catholics and Protestants, some 40 of them in a nearby city. She entertained them all. But then came the death of her husband. He was about 20 years older than she, and Catherine went to the cemetery and herself delivered the funeral oration. She said, "I know I'll be told that I'm trying to be Dr. Katrina. No, not that. I'm Mary Magdalene coming from the garden to say that I have seen the risen Lord." And then she collapsed. They sent her to Basel to stay with the minister there to recuperate, and Bucer, the chief minister in Strasbourg, sent a letter saying, "The widow of Arcel is coming to you. She's incredible in her care for the sick and the poor, the orphaned and the ailing. And now she's overcome with reproaches that she didn't do enough for her husband. Deal with her tenderly for his sake." Well, she was there only about 6 months. She was back in Strasbourg. And they let her keep the parsonage for 3 years, though she was no longer a minister's wife, because all that time it was filled with refugees who were coming in then, mainly from France, though also from other parts. Then came the Augsburg interim. The emperor, and I told you how he came up against Wittenberg, in a battle defeated the German forces, and then undertook to drive out Lutheranism by sheer force. Some of the ministers were banished, all of course were deprived of their posts, and Spanish priests were brought up to take over the churches which had been Protestant churches. Many of the ministers became school teachers and then secretly on the side carried on. Bucer of Strasbourg and his companion Phages were banished. They were invited to England. They were given a terminus for leaving. They overstayed 2 weeks, and during that time Catherine hid them. When they got to England, they wrote a letter of thanks. We have the letter and we have her reply. There was a man in the last century who copied thousands of 16th century letters. A good thing he did too, because most of those 16th century people had difficult handwritings, and his was quite clear. And there's a catalog of all of those letters. And I had the catalog, so I went through, and every time I found a woman, especially if I found Catherine, I sent over there and got a Xerox of the letter. So I got that piece of her correspondence. They wrote back to her and thanked her exceedingly for her kindness and sent her 2 gold gulden. She replied, "You put me to shame to think that I'd take a fetting for taking care of my dear ministers, meine lieben Predikanten. I thought at first that I would put your money, I would give it to the poor, as Joseph put the money into the sack of his brother." "No, no," she said, "I thought I'd send it back to you." But she said, "A man came in with children who had just escaped persecution, and a woman came in who had just seen her husband executed before her eyes. And I decided to take one of the gold pieces and divide it between them, and I'm returning the other one to you. You'll need it." Then the chief magistrate of Strasbourg was afflicted with leprosy. He had to give up his family, his friends, his office, and go outside of the city and live in a little quarantine hut. And his own daughter was not given permission to go and live with him and care for him. Catherine went.
She said, "I'm sorry, I couldn't come oftener. I've got so many to care for in Strasbourg." And then she wrote a little tract for him. There's only one copy left. It's in Zurich, and I got a Xerox of it. She began, "Lieber Ambrosiaster, dear Ambrosiaster, we've known each other for 30 years. You have been grievously afflicted. And at first you were rebellious against God. But now you have learned to thank him even in your infirmity. I have written for you a little meditation on the 51st Psalm and on the Creed and the Lord's Prayer, not in the hope that this may relieve you of your infirmity, but that it may sustain your spirit." And next, her nephew contracted syphilis. This was a very widespread plague in that period. It is believed to have been brought back to Europe by the sailors of Columbus from the New World. At any rate, it first appears in Naples and then spreads up through the north of Europe. The communication of the disease was not well understood, because it can be communicated by the contact of an open sore or even a kiss. And neither was medication advanced. Cities had special hospitals for the syphilitic. Her nephew went there, and she went there and lived in it for 2 years in order to take care of him, and then sent the government a long letter of advice as to how better to manage the hospital. Then the whole political situation changed. The emperor was driven out. Lutheranism was restored. The Peace of Augsburg gave a toleration. The Lutherans began to have superintendents, and some of them began to be rather lordly. And instead of railing against the Catholics, they began railing against the Anabaptists and Schwenkfeld, a spiritual reformer, and so on. Catherine was present at a Christmas service when a minister, now a superintendent, who formerly lived in their home, departed from the Christmas story to rail against Schwenkfeld. There, Schwenkfeld is still in Pennsylvania. She was very fond of Schwenkfeld. He had to leave Strasbourg, but she corresponded with him right along, and she rebuked this minister. He said, "You're a troubler of the peace of Israel." "Am I?" she said, and she published an apology. "You say I'm troubling the peace of Israel. I've done more pastoral work than any minister in Strasbourg. I've gone without food and sleep for 3 days at a time to take care of the plague-ridden and to carry their bodies for burial. I have visited those in prison, in heretics in prison, those under sentence of death, and you say I'm troubling the peace of Israel. You fellows talk as if you've been bought up by beasts in a jungle, the way you go after Schwenkfeld and these Anabaptists. And these Anabaptists show by their suffering their loyalty to the faith, and they share with us all of the essentials. You talk as if you'd like to see them burned like that poor Servetus in Geneva. You say that Strasbourg is a disgrace because she's more tolerant than other cities. Not yet, my dear fellow, but rather the glory of Germany. And I would remind you that the Good Samaritan, when he found the man who had fallen among thieves, did not ask to what denomination he belonged, but put him on his donkey. Remember the words of the Lord Jesus, to be humble and meek." At the very end of her life, Catherine was too weak to walk. A Schwenkfelder woman died. Her husband, who was not a Schwenkfelder, asked one of the ministers to take the funeral. He said he could do it only if first he praised her virtues and then added that she'd fallen away from the true faith. The husband wouldn't have it. He arranged to have the interment at 6 o'clock in the morning, when nobody would notice it. And Catherine's cell, too weak to walk, was taken in a carriage to the cemetery and conducted the entire service herself. There is a minute in the notes of the town council: if Catherine recovers, she shall receive a reprimand. It was never delivered. And now I think I have perhaps time to tell you one more, and this one from France. This is Charlotte de Bourbon. And the central date is about 1570, so this is later. It's in the period of the wars of religion in France. Her father was a staunch Catholic and a general on the Catholic side. Her mother equally staunch in devotion to the Catholic Church. They had a number of children, and they wanted one of the girls to be a nun, to pray for them, and also an abbess, for that was an important position socially, and she had an aunt who was an abbess, who was willing to stay on until Charlotte was old enough to take over. So they practically forced Charlotte at the age of 12 to take the vows as a nun. She wept, she protested, and she signed a document and got it witnessed that she didn't want it. 5 years later, under the similar circumstances, they made her an abbess, and more protests and more tears. But now the odd thing is that for some 15 years thereafter, she performed all of the functions of an abbess satisfactorily, which would indicate that her objection was at that time not religious, but she just didn't want it, that's all. But then she left, and that was because now she had become a Calvinist in her opinions, and I won't go into the process of how all that happened, but the evidence is unmistakable that it was now a matter of conviction. So where should she go? She consulted a relative, also a Bourbon and a staunch Protestant, Jeanne d'Albret, the Queen of Navarre, the mother of later Henry IV. Where should I go? She said, well, wait till your father cools off, and then maybe I can take care of you down in Navarre. But she said, I think you better get out of the country. Well, she couldn't very well go to Germany, because the Germans wouldn't receive the Calvinists unless they'd sign the Augsburg Confession. But there was one part of Germany which was Calvinist, the Palatinate, with Heidelberg as its capital. And Frederick III was a staunch Calvinist. So that's where she went. Now, she hadn't told her father. Her mother was dead. So it was Frederick who wrote to her father and said, mon cher cousin, my dear cousin, they were all cousins, most of these nobles, your daughter is with me, and I hope that you will grant her the liberty of her faith, which she has adopted out of loyalty to God, your dear cousin Frederick. The father wrote back, mon cher cousin, as children ought to be the comfort of old age, so is mine the cause of extreme discomfort. I am absolutely crushed. I've done for her everything, and yet she goes off like this, contrary to the faith of her fathers and her family. I didn't know she was discontented. If I had, I could have gotten her out and without creating any scandal. And now, without telling me or any of the family, she's gone to Germany. I won't give her a cent. She shall not profit from my labors, I can tell you. And I beg you not to harbor refugees running away in this fashion. If your daughter were with me, I'd look after her that way, and I hope you'll do this for me, your dear cousin Louis de Bourbon. Well, of course, he was right. He could have gotten her out, because she'd taken the vows under constraint. And she wasn't old enough to take the vows. But if she had, he would have expected her to be a good Catholic laywoman. And of course to marry a Catholic. Now, I can tell you briefly what will happen if she did that. Well, maybe I shouldn't digress, but it's the case of the sister of Henry IV in France. After he was a Huguenot, but finally, finding he couldn't rule France if he weren't a Catholic, he finally decided the parish was worth a mass and went back to Rome, and then he wanted to conciliate the Catholics, and he had only one disposable female in the family, so he called upon his daughter to marry the leader of the Catholic party. She said, dear brother, I'll do anything you say except change my faith. He said, oh, I'll fix it up with the Pope. The Pope will give a dispensation, so you can still be a Protestant. Well, the Pope didn't, and they married, but he excommunicated the husband, and he couldn't go to Easter communion. And the husband thought he was damned, and he begged her to save his soul by coming back to the church. He got all the best theologians in France to work on her, and she absolutely would not. He went to Rome. He begged the Pope to give it either a dispensation or a divorce, and the Pope referred it to a committee. And she wrote to her brother and said, I don't see any way out of this but by death. And she was dead 2 months, and one feels largely from emotion. Well, that's the kind of situation that would have confronted Charlotte if she had gone home as a Catholic lay woman. So she stayed in Heidelberg. After 2 years, there turned up in Heidelberg a young man who had come to try to get help for the Calvinists in the Netherlands. He was William of Orange. And I'll have to backtrack to say a word about him. He was the son of a German Lutheran who had vast estates in the Netherlands and knew he'd lose them if he didn't have a Catholic in the family, because heretics couldn't hold property. So he picked one son to be brought up as a Catholic in order to keep all of the estates. And this was William. He was reared, therefore, as a Catholic. He was very brilliant. He became the favorite of Charles, who was the Emperor Charles V. And when Charles abdicated in 1555, the shoulder on which he leaned was that of William of Orange. Charles abdicated in favor of his son Philip. He couldn't make him emperor, but he made him thereby king of Spain. He became Philip II of Spain. He and William were to become the greatest of foes. But for a time, William served under him until he found out that Philip was determined to make the Netherlands a dependency of Spain, to be fleeced for Spain's wars, and to stamp out Protestantism by introducing the Inquisition. Philip, therefore, withdrew. William withdrew from the Netherlands and started military efforts to resist the Spaniards. Well, he was thrown back, and so he went to France to try to get help from Admiral Coligny. Coligny said, I'll invade the Netherlands, because he wanted to start a war again with Spain, and he thought the best place was to strike in the Netherlands. But he said, I think you better get help from Germany, too. Well, the Germans wouldn't help unless the Calvinists would sign the Augsburg Confession. The only place was Heidelberg. And there William turns up. And he and Catherine, Charlotte, agreed to marry. But before the marriage, word came that the mangled body of Coligny was lying in the streets of Paris in the massacre of St. Bartholomew. No help from France. But William decided to carry on, and Charlotte joined him at Antwerp, and then went on into Holland. The first thing she did was to try to make a haven or shelter for his family. She took in his brother and his children by previous marriages. His firstborn son was kidnapped and taken to Spain. He was 28 years a hostage in Spain. He'd been named Philip for Philip of Spain. There was a daughter, and by a second marriage, there were two. She took them in, and in 7 years, she bore William 6 children. She tried to establish rapport with her father and wrote him repeatedly, but got never a reply. In addition to all of the family, she became practically the civil ruler of Holland, because her husband was out constantly on the field, and all the petitions came into her, often had to be settled right away, and so she actually became the administrator of Holland in addition to all of these household cares. Well, the war dragged on. A great Spanish general came and overran what is now Belgium, up to the Rhine. Then he did a wise thing. He permitted all of the Calvinists who wanted to go to Holland. And Ghent was almost depopulated. This is the real beginning of the separation of Belgium and Holland. Of course, it made it a bit harder for Holland, because they had to take in thousands of refugees. But in the long run, it was to their gain, because they brought so many skills. And commerce passed from Antwerp to Amsterdam, but not right away. Well, then the war continued until the point came where it became obvious that by military means, Holland could not be conquered, partly because of all the rivers and all of the dikes. Then, Philip of Spain had recourse to the last weapon, assassination. he put out a proclamation which put William under the ban. He said he has been guilty of practicing religious liberty, and he's married an abbess, contrary to all the laws of nature of God and man. Therefore, he is to be put under the ban, and anyone who kills him will be rewarded with 25,000 ducats d'or. If he is a civilian, he shall be a noble. If he is a criminal, he shall be pardoned. And this we do in the name of God. That was too much for Charlotte's father, because this assailed the honor of the House of Bourbon, that he had committed a crime by marrying an abbess. And the father came out with a manifesto. I, Louis de Bourbon, the Duke of Montpensier, declare that my dearly beloved daughter Charlotte married my dearly beloved son-in-law William of Orange, and that I approve of their marriage as much as if I had been there and signed the contract. And I hope that all of the potentates of Europe will respect this marriage and all of the children born therefrom. He didn't write Charlotte. But she sent him a present from her five-year-old daughter named Louise for Grandpa Louis. She had embroidered a girdle of purple with a silver fringe, and we had the letter which he wrote back. My dear little granddaughter, you could not have done anything that would have pleased me more than to send me your first work. This lovely girdle, I wrap it about my gown every night when I go to bed that I may think of you. Of course I shall think of you always, and I will send you something in return. May God give you his richest blessing, your loving grandpa, Louis de Bourbon. But in the meantime, the band was at work. William put out his great apology, in which he gave defense of all he had done, and described the atrocities of Spain. I won't go into the detail, and wound up by saying, I will stand firm, je le maintiendrai. But one day when he was at meat, a sinister-looking young man came and asked the guards to be allowed to approach him. They held him off, but he finally persuaded them that he wanted to present a petition. They let him come forward. William wrote. He drew a pistol and shot, and it went through the upper palate and out by the ear. William was able to speak. He begged them not to kill him, but they cut him down. And they found on his body prayers in Spanish to the angel Gabriel and the Virgin Mary to enable him to accomplish the assassination. William's life was now very severely in danger, and for some weeks it was doubtful whether he would ever recover. In the meantime, Charlotte nursed him, though she herself was not fully recovered from the last childbirth. When it became apparent that he would recover, he was assassinated later, but not at this time. When it became apparent that he would recover, Charlotte relaxed and collapsed, and in 2 weeks, she was gone. And then came a letter from Grandpa Louis to little Louise. My dear, I am so sorry that your dear mother did not live to bring up you and your sisters to be good girls, as I know you are, and you will be, if you obey your father and live as your dear mother would have wished. I'll do anything I can for you. Your loving grandfather, Louis de Bourbon. And then came another letter from the Duke's second wife, a very young wife, and she from the most Catholic family in France. My dear girl, I'm so sorry that you have lost your mother, for what this means to you and for what it means to me, for she was so kind to me. We don't know how. I'll do what I can for you, and I'll put in a good word with your grandfather, your loving grandmother, Charlotte of Lorraine. Why should you have to put in a good word with grandfather after what he'd written? We understand when we see the letter which William of Orange wrote to Grandfather, "Mon cher cousin, I thank you for your letters which have just reached me, and nothing pleases me more than your kind offer to take and bring up my little daughter Louise. In 2 weeks we shall have her ready. It will take so many days to go to Calais. I hope that you will have a litter or a coach to take her. I am sure that she will have a fine upbringing. Yours, William of Orange." He must have thought that a fine upbringing in the home of Grandfather would mean a Catholic upbringing. But William did not regard the Mass as such an abomination as intolerance. And Grandpa Louis did respect the faith of little Louise. But I might add that she married the son of the Frederick of Heidelberg who had befriended her mother. And she became the mother of Frederick V, who was the great leader of the Calvinists in the 30 Years' War. Well, I don't think we've got much time left, for I have been so loquacious.